third part of the interview with Archie M. Bolster took place in Falls Church, Virginia on May 3rd, 1988.
Okay. Now, Mr. Bolster, I have a few follow-up questions from our last interview meeting. When you were at the embassy in the 1960s, how closely did you follow the Iranian popular press?
Well, I generally tried to look at the headlines of the papers every day, and we had also translations prepared of press articles of particular interest by our political national employees. Mm-hmm. And so we got a flavor of the press. It took time to read whole articles in Farsi, so as I say, I generally scan the headlines and read a few articles and read some of the articles in a humorous political satirical magazine called Tofik, which often had both cartoons and little humorous stories about various things, but with, usually with some kind of sarcastic or ironic point to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've read that as the Vietnam War escalated in the mid-60s, that the press ran very sharp criticism of American policy in Vietnam. Now, how much did you know about that at the time?
Well, I was aware of these articles in general terms, and I was aware of the popular feeling about the Vietnam War from my frequent discussions with Iranian students. I used to give some English lessons at the Iran America Society, not necessarily formal lessons, but just go there and sit down with some students or go in a room and you know, just mingle with the students and talk to them because they wanted to practice their English. And from those discussions, I heard a lot of criticism about the Vietnam War, people feeling that we were oppressing the people of Vietnam and, you know, taking our own interests as paramount and controlling the country for our own desires. And, you know, I tried to explain that, in my view, we did not have any territorial goals that were, you know, aggrandizement goals in Vietnam, and that we were there to help support the South Vietnamese government against invasion of from the north, and I gave them all these points, but I could tell in the discussions that it was not easy to convince them of that. And then, of course, they all sort of drew parallels to other countries, saying, well, now, if you do that in Vietnam, would you go into any other country, you know, if they were attacked from the outside? And they obviously were, although not saying it, they were thinking of the potential for something like that in Iran, and wondering if we would come in and you know, send troops and everything like that in case there was some kind of an invasion of Iran. I mean, that was a sort of background you could tell in the way they were questioning it. Mm-hmm.
Did you yourself see some of the critical articles that went, or the press period during this period?
Well, I'm sure I did, but I can't say that I recall any particular ones. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just a general awareness, both from press and from contacts with people, that there was a lot of questioning about the war. Yeah. And I gave the policy line when I talked to people, and I must say, looking back on it, I believed it myself at that time, but subsequent to my return to the States back in the late 60s, I began to have doubts myself and some of the press stories I read about various aspects of the war that I found very unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Now, apparently the Shah himself gave public support to American policy in Vietnam, to Johnson's policy. But the press, I guess it was a fairly controlled press at the time, was running critical articles. Well, did that discrepancy create any discussion, lead to any discussion in the embassy of the press running critical articles, whereas the Shah supporting the war?
Well, not very much, because the support that the Iranians gave was pretty minimal, actually. They sent medical teams to Vietnam to help support our side, and they also, I believe, provided some other kind of support. I think they sent some planes at one time.
72. Yeah.
But, you know, compared with some of our other allies who had troops there and took casualties and so on, the Iranians really put very little into it. And it was a campaign that was run out of Washington for a while called More Flags in Vietnam. And the policy was to get as many friendly countries to support our effort as possible. And every time one country sent some group in to help, then that was one more flag in Vietnam. So it was very important that the Iranians, and they've sensed that, I'm sure the Shah was well aware that it was important to appear to support us heavily in Vietnam, but even though it was just a question of having enough people there to fly the flag. And we had constant problems with this medical mission. It was just awful. I mean, they were sending messages back and forth to their families, and you know, they were unhappy being out there, and they were constantly changing, and I'm really not sure that they ever accomplished a great deal of good, because they were really totally out of their element, you know, going out to Vietnam and trying to support this U.S.-led, allied effort. They really were basically there because the Shah said we're going to support this, and they went through the motions, but I don't think we really got all that much benefit from their being there. And certainly the embassy and the officers who worked on that project were just constantly running back and forth with messages to and from the Iranian group. And
who were some of the people who worked on this at the embassy? Do you remember?
I really don't remember anymore now. But we had problems with, you know, Iranian morale out there, that people would send messages back in Latin text, but with Farsi words. Mm-hmm. And so as we would receive these, of course, we could read, those who spoke Farsi could read what was being said. And it were basically just, you know, people who were totally out of their element there and unhappy and wanted to get back, and were constantly changing people because people didn't want to stay there that long. So it was quite an operational problem.
Mm. Sounds like it. Another issue in the late 60s was that in 1967, the U.S., maybe the Shah jointly, declared Iran to be a developed nation. And Iran was treated as a developed nation. There was no more aid mission. Aid mission was phased out.
Right.
Grant aid was phased out as well.
Right.
Can you explain the reasoning that led to that decision?
Well, I think basically it was the feeling that we had given aid to Iran ever since Point 4 back in 1948-49, and you know, this was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And that at some point you had to feel that the country had been given enough aid. If the aid was being successful, then the country must have progressed to a certain point where it wouldn't need constant aid. Furthermore, this was in the era of the so-called takeoff doctrine, where it was felt that countries needed support in certain periods, but as they, like the plane running down the runway, got up airspeed, they could take off and fly on their own, so that you had to at some point sort of declare victory and go on. And so it was a policy that was very much by mutual agreement. For one thing, the Shah, I think, had always resented the discussions that we used to have every year with him about how much military aid he could afford, because since we were still paying aid, we therefore had the sort of mirror right to sit down with his people and say, now, do you really need that many divisions, or do you really need that many planes and whatever? And he felt, I think, that once the aid ended, that he would be more free to do what he thought was necessary. Also, our aid had dwindled down by then to a relatively low level, and I think it fit both Iranian and American policy goals to stop the aid.
Okay. Now, a few minutes ago you mentioned the Iran-American Society. Did that have an official, was that sort of a semi-official organization? Was that, did that have an official connection to the U.S. government or with the embassy?
Well, it had a, as a binational center, it was operated under the same procedures we have in many countries, where you have a board of directors that's made up of host country nationals and Americans together, mm-hmm. and they mutually decide on the types of programs that will be undertaken and how the center is to be managed. And I think the Iranian American Society in general was an extremely successful operation. We had not only the big main center, which had a large new building by this time with a very nice auditorium and you know, lots of smaller rooms for affairs. You could have film showings and you could have major plays because it was a really major stage. And mm-hmm. so on. There was an outdoor theater as well. You could show movies outdoors or have outdoor theatrical productions. It was a very active place, and it used to pack in the people. I remember some period when they showed movies from the Chaplin period and from the Laurel and Hardy period and so on. And those were just, they were really sought after. I mean, tickets were free, but you had to... as I recall, you had to apply for them in advance, and used to have packed houses for those things. So there was a lot of interest in the things that they put on. There were, of course, I think it's fair to say there were probably more American productions shown to Iranians than there were Iranian productions shown to Americans. I mean, the basic focus was to give a picture of American society, a large picture of American society in all respects, mm-hmm. political, social, theatrical, mm-hmm. cultural, et cetera, et cetera. But there were occasional Iranian-produced affairs that, to give Americans an idea, some Iranian mm-hmm. thoughts and ideas, but it was a much less pervasive theme. Then there was a student center, which was operated by a small group of Iranians and Americans, and located right near the Tehran University, and that was extremely active. It was really basically a house, standard Iranian type house of that area, with I think four floors, and there were constant streams of people going in and out of the place. So it was kind of a lounge and discussion center and whatever that the students could go to, which they really needed because they didn't have anything particularly like that. I mean, you don't have that many student facilities like we're used to at American universities. They don't quite think in the same terms. So this student center provided a really welcome spot for people to go and just have discussions with each other and just sit around or whatever. And I went to a number of affairs there, talked to Iranians, and so we had a very active director of it, Mrs. Ziai, who did a fine job and made it really a popular place with the Iranian students. That is mentioned in
yes.
James Bell's book. He does make the point that there weren't a great number of Americans who attended the student center. And he's right, but there were people who went there, not only me, but there were other people who went on a regular basis to take part in some of these informal gatherings. So I think they were very useful activities.
Were the Americans on the board of the society, the Iranian American Society, were they official Americans or private, like people from the embassy, were they on the board, or do you recall anything about the structure?
Well, I can't really recall now. Just who I think that they were both official Americans and some other Americans resident there, but I really can't recall in detail.
Okay. Now, at the end of our last meeting, you were talking about Richard Helms as ambassador. Now, to what extent did he, like some of the other ambassadors you mentioned, tend to serve as a conduit for the Shah's request Did he follow the patterns set by Meyer and MacArthur, or did he operate on different lines?
Well, I think he was somewhat more independent in the sense that he would be able to talk to the Shah as a person of similar interests and experience and prestige, and did not feel he had to be just a conduit for the Shah's demands and wishes. They had actually been in school together in Switzerland as young men in the academy at the Swiss school at Le Rosay, and so they really got on quite well on a personal basis, and I think they each respected each other for their accomplishments, and so I think they had a somewhat more even and equal relationship. That doesn't mean that that Helms didn't pass on to Washington all of the things that Shah was concerned about. I remember many times he would go on at length with Washington about the Shah's unhappiness about the price of spare parts and American training and so on, because he felt we had to get this across to Washington to show that there was unhappiness and that maybe something should be done about these complaints. But I think he had a good give and take relationship with the Shah, and he was the kind of person who would give our views to the Shah, as well as taking the Shah's messages to the States.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the other influentials at the embassy during this period, the mid-70s? Some of the other key officials, I guess, in political and economic affairs.
You're speaking now in the 60s or in the
70s? In the mid-70s, in your second...
Mid-70s.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you'd have to go down the various sections, and the people who headed each section were obviously influential in talking to the Shah's government people. I mean, talking to ministers and deputy ministers and so on. But I... You know, I don't think I can comment on individuals who had influence in terms of who had more or less, whatever. But Miklos obviously had a lot of influence because he was the deputy chief of mission, and he had been country director for Iran, and also had served in Iran before. So he had a lot of friends and contacts that he had made before, with whom he continued to have close relations.
What was your appraisal of him as DCM, of Miklos?
Well, I think I would subscribe to some of the criticisms made of him in Jim Bell's book, because he tended to deal almost exclusively with the establishment, people that he had either had known before or now knew as, you know, the top people in the government, and I don't think he ever made an effort to break out of that group of people. He's quite satisfied to deal with all the people in the panoply of power at the top there, and felt that if there was anything else to be gained from other people, that, you know, somewhere in the embassy there'd be somebody in touch with him, so that he would just stay with these top people. And when, you know, when he entertained, it was generally with a certain high-level circle of friends and acquaintances and contacts that he knew from his work. So I think that there was a need for more branching out, and yet at this time we had fewer political officers in the 70s than we had had when I was there in the mid-60s. Another factor that Jim Bell points out in his book. So, you know, it was sort of topsy-turvy. In other words, our interests were gaining in importance in Iran. The number of people that we had in the country, even, I mean, the number of Americans in the country was growing at enormous rates. And yet, mm-hmm. the number of people in our political sections who were actually keeping up with all kinds of political developments that would affect our status in the country were being cut way back. So it didn't really make any sense. And we spent a lot of time doing analyses of what the impact of growing numbers of Americans would be in Iran. And, you know, a lot of us were aware that, particularly when you had people who came into Iran just because they were under contract to do certain jobs and who had basically no interest in fitting into the country or really, you know, knowing about Iranian customs and history or anything. It's, the more people you had like that, the more potential there was for problems. And there were problems. And we kept trying to get the companies to realize that they had to be more careful, but, you know, they were just pell-mell in operation to get over there with as many people as possible and make as much money as possible. And Bell Helicopter stands out as probably the worst example because they recruited a lot of people who had been in Vietnam and had either not been employed in the States or had maybe occasional jobs in the States, and then suddenly they saw another chance to go out and make lots of money teaching a new class of people, a new nationality of people how to fly helicopters. They'd been doing this in Vietnam, and now they suddenly were brought into Iran to train Iranians to fly helicopters. And many of those people just had no idea what the country was like. They didn't care. They didn't care to know about the way people behaved or what was proper behavior. They just did whatever they thought was proper in their view. And there were all kinds of stories like girls in shorts and halter tops riding motorcycles into town in Isfahan to buy things at stores, and just really total flagrant inappropriate behavior for the situation that they were in. And they saw no reason to do anything other than that. They felt they were brought in there to do the job of training people to fly helicopters, and they were going to do that. And their lifestyle was of no concern to anybody.
Did this lead to any complaints from the government, or just as far as more concern with both citizens in the country or Iranian citizens?
Almost nothing in the way of complaints from the government. Because the orders were that the Shah wanted certain things done. So, and if you want to suddenly teach a lot of people to fly helicopters, you just set up the arrangements and off you go. So he was more concerned about the end result, and I don't think he worried particularly about the side effects. I think he thought that any onus would fall on the U.S., on the United States, and not on him. But of course, that was a miscalculation, because gradually the resentment of the Western presence in Iran became a factor in increasing animosity toward him and the royal family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you said there was fewer political officers in this period. Was this a budgetary decision, a budgetary problem that led to this, or was it a political decision or a policy decision that accounted for fewer people following internal political affairs?
Well, I think it became a budgetary decision just by default, and I think one reason is that you had this so often misconstrued book, The Ugly American, by Burdick and Lederer, which had shown that the ugly Americans, meaning people who were just everyday citizens without any, not being glamorous diplomats and so on, but just shirt-sleeved people out there doing a job, they were good people, contrary to what people now think of when they talk about the ugly American. In that book, the ugly Americans were the good guys, the ones who went out and worked in the provinces and met people and tried to learn about the country and learn their language and so on. The people in the capital and the diplomatic corps and so on were perceived as the bad guys, the ones who didn't really know the country well. And anyway, the book was a very hard-hitting criticism of the U.S. government for not having enough concern about language and customs and history of the people in the country where you're serving. So as a result of that, a lot of money was put in the 50s and 60s into language training and area training. And I think once that perception sort of subsided and everyone thought, well, you know, now we've done all this training and we've got a whole lot of people out there who are well trained, then it sort of gradually dissipated and there was not the same concern nor the same amount of money available, and they just didn't train as many people. I think that's about as simple as it was. We continued to designate positions for language officers, continued to give training, but I think it just lost the impetus that it had early on.
How many on the embassy staff actually spoke Farsi? Among the political officers or the economic officers, that you...
This is now in the in the 70s, mid 70s. Oh, I think probably you could say about 10. And these were generally in the political area. Very few people. In fact, I don't... Yeah, I guess there were one or two in economic affairs. Yeah, who spoke Farsi, but mainly in the political area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of work did you do as a political officer in the mid-70s?
Well, because there were fewer people in political affairs than had been true in my earlier period, I did a lot more things. I wasn't so narrowly focused. And in general, I covered the entire internal political scene. Although, even there, I can't make a firm boundary because I did some reporting also about international affairs, such as Iran's relations with India and Pakistan and the Indian Ocean area, and some of these affairs as well. So I had to cover both, I would say, but probably with more of an emphasis on the internal, because the political counselor did some of the international activities, and then we had, that was Hawthorne Mills, and Henry Precht was totally full-time on political military affairs, and then Escudero was on internal affairs, and then Stemple came, and he also was doing some of both, some international and some internal. So that was really about the status of the State Department people. And then there were other people, agency people, who had Farsi knowledge as well and who covered, again, both internal and external affairs.
Oh, the CIA people.
Yeah.
Now, among the documents that were captured at the U.S. Embassy in 1979 and later published, and the volumes of capture documents, was a report called Decision Making in Iran, which is dated July 22nd, 1976.
Right.
Apparently you wrote this study?
Yeah.
Was it done on request? On your own initiative?
Well, it basically grew out of a discussion with Charles Naz, who was the country director at the time, and he came out on an orientation and familiarization trip, and I accompanied him in southern Iran, Isfahan, Shiraz, Bandar Abbas, Ghoramshar, Abadan, so on. And in the course of that, we discussed the reporting that was being sent in from the field. We generally had a list of topics that we would report on, and we would send that list into Washington and say, we propose to do reports on the following subjects, and then they would come back and say, of those subjects, we prefer that you do 1, 3, 5, and 7, or whatever. I mean, they would tell us which they considered higher priority, and then we would do the other ones at a lower priority. And one of the things that we discussed when he came out was, he phrased the question one day when we were just sitting around after a long day of traveling, we were just sitting around discussing things, and he asked about this, how are decisions made? Does the Shah really decide everything, or, you know, how much does he listen to the people in the ministries and in his government? And then he said, you know, that would be a good subject for a report. So we more or less discussed it that way, and I put that on our list as a priority report that we should do. You know, it took a lot of research to do it, so it dragged on a bit before I finally got it out. But I think it was a contribution at the time, because the Shah was, of course, as a focal point for the government, always given credit for whatever happened, and then if things went wrong, he never took the blame, because the blame was then assigned to somebody in the government, and that was the way he ran things. You know, he took credit for everything that worked right, and anything that went wrong was the fault of some minister or under minister or whatever. But because the country became so active on the international scene, and so much was made of its development goals and all the very great plans the Shah had, which he kept talking about, that we're going to put him and his country at the level of France and Great Britain and so on. You know, he talked about the great civilization in which his country was going to be the equal of these world powers like France and England. There were just never-ending projects. I mean, there was going to be a subway project. There was going to be the great new square of the Shah and the people, which would be the biggest square in the entire world, bigger than Red Square and bigger than anything anywhere. And they were going to relocate the entire diplomatic establishment up there in this Abbasabad area, which was pretty much empty. They were going to just create a tremendous new facility there. They were just doing everything new airport, new roads everywhere, just never-ending project. And so people began to say, well, you know, how can they do all this? Who's calling all the shots? How can they? And if the Shah is running the country, how can he possibly run all these little development plans? And how can he be consulted on everything about a subway and airport and on and on? So that was another one of the reasons for the report, was to sort of analyze how the Shah could sit on top of this tremendously active government and still be consulted on everything.
Mm-hmm. How did you do the research for this kind of report? Was it interviews or credit sources? Or?
Well, I used basically everything I had. That is, I did have sources such as some of the work that Marvin Zonas had done on the political elites in Iran, questionnaires for people. And I talked to a lot of Iranians. I did my own sort of version of what Zonas did, but without, you know, having it on paper. Mm-hmm. I just asked people, who do you think are the most important people in the government, and why are they so important? And then I would just compare those lists to see if I was, you know, including all the people that all of my contacts mentioned. There was, of course, very little on the Iranian scene in the way of that kind of analysis. I mean, if they did that sort of analysis, it was always done orally with each other. They would never be so bold as to put it down on paper. So in that sense, there wasn't anything to go on. But through a lot of interviews, I got a lot of ideas from people as to who they thought were the main movers and shakers of the government, and then I followed a lot of particular cases, how decisions were made on particular projects, I talked with Mr. Macy, who had headed the Civil Service Commission and was over there working for the Shah and establishing various personnel rules for the government and so on. I got some ideas from him because he dealt with a lot of these top officials. Just both Americans and Iranians and some foreign observers of the scene as well. I just compared notes with all them and put together the findings.
What were some of your main Iranian contacts in terms of doing this kind of a project? Or I guess more in general, the main people you
with? They're conveniently listed in my contact report from 1976, which I did before I left and which unfortunately stayed in the files 3 years after I left and was seized as part of the documents which the Iranians have now published. So my contact list with all of my frank comments about who I talked to and how to get in touch with them and where their strong points or weak points analytically were and what kind of information they could provide, all that's down in my contact list, so it's pretty much there to read. But I would certainly single out two people. One is Rahmat Movadam, who was a longtime National Fronter, and I've mentioned his name before, I think, in previous discussions. Former National Fronter, and eventually even formed his own political party during a brief time when the Shah let various people come forth with their political ideas. He headed something called the Radical Party. And then after the revolution, he was made Governor General of Azerbaijan by Khomeini, but then he later had a falling out with Khomeini over separation of church and state, which he thought was the appropriate way to go, and Khomeini obviously didn't, and so then he was eventually on a list for interrogation and eventually escaped from the country and lives now in California. But he was a consistently good source because he was quite a student of Iranian history and a thoughtful person who would give you ideas about whatever subject you needed to discuss. He had so many contacts and such experience that he was very, very useful as a contact. I also found Hidayatullah Mateen Daftari a very good source. Again, he's one of the people mentioned in Jim Bill's book. Again, a National Front person, the grandson of Mossadegh and so on. So you had to allow for his views, but he was a well-educated guy, a sharp lawyer, occasionally imprisoned by the government, but whenever you could get in touch with him and get to see him, he was invariably a good source of information of what was going on and various views. So those are two, but I had lots of different sources. I do feel that I tried to break out of the mold of the standard contacts that people had, because I developed some of my own contacts previously, and when I came back, I reestablished contact with them, and through them, I tried to meet other people, and you know, broaden the range of contacts. Even in the clerical side, I mentioned before one of the clerics that I was dealing with. So.
Oh, that the Ayatollah Khatsi.
Yeah. But you know, these were just attempts to keep well informed, but in a very busy time when there were so many demands on our time in terms of the required reports and the social activities that were scheduled and the need to get out on some field trips and see the countryside, which I always found very rewarding, but hard to schedule because there was always something that needed to be done in Tehran that would keep you away from these trips. I did take trips still when I was assigned to Tehran later, and always found them very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. But they're just because of the declining number of political officers and the expanding field of activity that we were supposed to keep up with. It was really a very busy time.
One of the classified documents was released by state, was a report by the country desk officers around 74, 75, which I guess NAS, signatures on the report. And it said that the people at the country desk wanted analysis of the forces that would influence a post-Shaw situation, or looking towards the future when the Shaw dies or is assassinated or whatever, what will happen.
Yeah.
In the wake of that event, were reports on that issue prepared?
Yes, sure. Because that, that was often a discussion topic. The Shah was so active and traveled so much that it wouldn't be hard to imagine his plane going down in a storm, and then suddenly, who runs the country when he's gone? And so there was a lot of attention to that. We had not only periodic discussions of it, but we had required reports that would be redone every so often as to what we thought would happen if the Shah passed from the scene. And obviously a lot of it depended on who his closest advisors were. When he married the third time to Farah Diba, he eventually set up a regency council with her to head it. And so that was the first time, I think, that he sort of formalized the arrangements that would he hoped be in place after he left the scene. I think one could say, looking back on it, that this was probably proof that he knew he was beginning to have physical problems which might remove him from the scene, the fact that he gave so much attention to this. At the time, he justified it just by saying that he felt it was necessary to ensure the continued pursuit of the White Revolution's goals, and that he was concerned about his son, the Crown Prince, who was by then a teenager, and he felt that he had to give this poor fellow a chance to do an adequate job. I mean, the Shah always had in mind how it was for him. When his father suddenly left the scene in 1940 at the hands of the British, the Shah became the king, and he really had no experience. I mean, he'd been given academic training, but and he'd been to the military academy, but really in terms of practical experience, he had none, because his father was such a powerful figure that he did everything, and the young Shah just sort of watched and learned from that. So the Shah, I think, felt in turn that he wanted to prepare a better transition for his son. So he groomed the boy extensively with foreign travel and different languages. The poor fellow grew up learning about three languages. And in fact, there were rumors when he was born that he might be retarded or something, because he didn't speak for a long time. And as I understand the story, it turns out that he didn't speak because he had his father speaking Persian to him, his mother speaking French, and someone else speaking English. And so he was just
totally confused
by these three languages that were always going around him, so he just didn't speak for a long time. But he did grow up to be a very sophisticated young man, and I think the Shah had this in mind constantly, that he wanted to prepare the boy for taking over. He didn't, I think of Farah as running the country for very long. She was the chairman of this Regency Council, and she was supposed to run things, but definitely running him for the young Shah until he could, be old enough to take over on his own.
That's interesting. Now this is kind of a general question, but when you were stationed in Iran in the mid-70s, what was your overall appraisal of the political situation, and I guess the economic situation as well, in Iran?
Well, that's a tall order,
yeah.
But Basically, what I always said in my oral briefings of correspondents and visitors and various things is that the country is not nearly as stable as it appears on the surface, because it is a developing country and it has all the problems of any developing country. But it's a rich developing country, which doesn't make it any easier to develop. I mean, people thought, for example, that a country that's rich should be able to develop easily because they can buy whatever they need. They can buy either the physical resources, or they can buy the advice and training that they need.
They're from the solar.
Yeah.